I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, it's been a milestone week for gay marriage rights. Yesterday, this nation's capital began issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Today, one of Latin America's most important capitals, Mexico City, legalizes gay marriage and adoption. So we'll go to Mexico City for a report on how that development is being received there. That in a few minutes. But first, back to one of this country's most pressing political and social issues, health care. Tomorrow marks a year since President Obama first kicked off his efforts to overhaul this country's health care system, or at least its health insurance system. Yesterday, he called on Congress to get it done and schedule a final vote.
Every idea has been put on the table. Every argument has been made. Everything there is to say about health care has been said, and just about everybody has said it. So now's the time to make a decision about how to finally reform health care so that it works.
We noticed that the president surrounded himself with doctors and physicians, assistants and nurses. And when he made yesterday's speech, from time to time on this program, we've checked in with a diverse group of doctors to get a sense of what the health debate looks like from their perspective. Among our group are people who take care of patients from all backgrounds, urban, rural, all ethnicities, those with insurance and without. So back with us today are two of those doctors we've been checking in with, Dr. David Ellington. He's a family physician in Lexington, Virginia, and Dr. Carolyn Barley-Britton. She's an associate professor of clinical neurology at Columbia University. She's also immediate past president of the National Medical Association. I welcome you both back. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you. Michelle, it's nice to be back in touch.
Well, likewise. So before we jump into the discussion, I just want to play a little bit more about from the president's speech yesterday at the White House. In effect, he was saying enough is enough. Here it is.
We have debated this issue thoroughly, not just for the past year, but for decades. Reform has already passed the House with a majority. It has already passed the Senate with a supermajority of 60 votes. And now it deserves the same kind of up or down vote that was cast on welfare reform, that was cast on the children's health insurance program, that was used for COBRA health coverage for the unemployed, and, by the way, for both Bush tax cuts, all of which had to pass Congress with nothing more than a simple majority.
So, Dr. Barley-Britton, obviously he was talking about the politics of how, or the mechanics of how he would wish the Congress to move forward at this point. But I wanted to ask you, do you agree with him on the merits? You just think it's time to take a vote on this, move on?
I completely agree with him on the merit. I actually don't see that any of the discussion that people could have had in the past year has been entirely fruitful, forthcoming, or honest. And I think healthy debate and differences of opinion are really part of the fabric of democracy. That is fine. But this process early on was politicized for embarrassment and achieving political gain rather than seeing if there really could be hammered out consensus among competing ideas. And I think that at this point, for the American people and for health care in general and access to it, we really need to move forward. I just see nothing to gain in starting over, scrapping the bill. We have had this. It'll be another decade. The growth of premium increases is unsustainable. I don't see how individuals or employers can sustain approximate doubling of their insurance rates every 3 to 5 years. I think we just are at the brink. And given the recession that we have, if we don't take our steps now, they will not help us. And I just think it's do it or suffer the consequences, which I believe to be dire.
Dr. Ellington, what about you?
Well, I agree with many of the things that Dr. Britton said. This has been discussed at length. The question is this the best bill that will ever come out for America, or is this the best bill right now? We believe that there are so many strong points in this bill that we absolutely need to go ahead and get something passed. And when I say we, I'm talking about the American Academy of Family Physicians. The present situation, as Dr. Britton said, is absolutely unsustainable. And what is not said when we talk about the cost of doing something is the cost of doing nothing. And the cost of doing nothing just cannot continue to exist. I In my office, we are seeing more and more and more people that are coming in with a little notation on their charts that say no insurance, and that has really increased significantly in the last 5 to 6 months.
So last 5 to 6 months.
Yep.
That's interesting. Well, you've always, Dr. Ellington, treated both. You have both a rural practice and an urban practice, and you have a clinical practice as well as a private practice. So you've always had a mix of patients who both have insurance and don't have insurance. So I wanted to ask, though, obviously you're really busy and you're there to take care of people's medical issues. But to the degree that this comes up in conversation, do your patients have a sense of urgency about this, too? Because what the Republicans have been saying is that the public is against this at the moment, that they've changed their minds, and they'd rather that's their perspective on this. What are your patients telling you?
Well, my patients don't get into the politics of it, but they get into what affects them. And there's several times, I mean, this happened to me yesterday when I would say, I believe that you need this test. And they look me right in the eye and say, Doctor, I can't afford this test. And this has tremendous influence on how you treat people. And I'm not talking about some way out test that they don't. I'm talking about a basic blood test to monitor their cholesterol or a basic X-ray. Another interesting thing, Michelle, you know, I'm the medical director for our local free clinic. And our director told us we are serving 6% of the population in our catchment area right now in our free clinic. 6% of the population comes to the free clinic. This is unsustainable to keep doing this.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with a couple of the doctors we've been checking in with throughout the year as the health care debate has worked its way through Congress. We're speaking with Drs. Carolyn Barley-Britton and Dr. David Ellington. Dr. Britton, what about you? How's the insurance issue playing out in your practice? You're a specialist.
Well, I see it most often. My patients mostly have insurance, but what I see are patients whom I haven't seen for a while who are going to lose their jobs and lose their insurance. And they will come in, because I'm a specialist, and they will come in desperate. I need you to check me out, and I need you to get anything that you can get, because I'm losing my job in such and such a day, or my COBRA is running out at such and such a time. So people are living with a finite definition to the insurance, and then they have to seek out care. Now, if they have a chronic problem that needs recurrent care, which is what a number of my patients have, then they're in trouble. Because they will fall into the problem where they don't get medication. I have patients who try to stretch their medications. They don't take medications as their internist prescribed because they're trying to, quote, make it last. If they're in this bridge where their job is going to go away, they may have unemployment or their unemployment has ended, or they can't carry their COBRA because of other expenses, or some family stressor occurs that none of it is sufficient for them to actually pay their living expenses. I agree with Dr. Ellington. Many people personalize this. And if you go and talk to all the individuals, you find that every individual in the country, the majority, will have a health cost story. And so they may not want to get into the politics of this, but we as a nation are going to have to stand up and say we're going to have to move forward. I think it is significant that the majority of physicians for the first time are in support of doing something. We understand that the bill may not be perfect and there may be other things to do. And there's going to be a time to implementation where the pain is going to continue. So we understand that, but it really is something that the majority of the physicians are now on board. That has actually never been the case. So it means that physicians and patients alike, in their individual office experiences, are sharing an experience about the vagaries of our current health insurance system that directly impacts quality of care and access to care that some of the people in the political part of the spectrum seem to be unaware of or dismissive of.
And that's interesting to me, because both of you are reporting that one of the things that the president said in his speech is that the status quo is unsustainable. And he said that this is something that he feels both parties agree on. And you're both seeing ways in which the status quo is interfering with the kind of care you think is is optimal. So, Dr. Ellington, I'm curious, though, why then, I'm asking you to speculate, why then you feel that there's still this argument about, you know, start over and start from scratch? Is it that you think that the fear of change overrides the fear of what's going to happen if it doesn't change?
Well, Michelle, I'll just take you back to a town hall meeting that I went to for my congressional representative. And the degree of misinformation that was voiced on both sides of the conversation to me was fairly astounding. I think that in the political process that there is a tremendous amount of misinformation that gets out there, and people are afraid of change. They're afraid of losing what they have. They're afraid of the unknown. And they don't understand the implications of what will happen if nothing happens. And no one has really told that story well on the political scene, that if you keep it just as it is, this is what will happen. We cannot sustain a healthy workforce for our economy if we continue doing what we're doing right now. And I try to tell people who say we can't change, I tell them, listen, health is absolutely fundamental to the economic power of this country because you have to have a healthy workforce. And the way we're heading right now with our health delivery system, we can't sustain that.
Well, we have to leave it there for now, but we'll be checking in with both of you again, and we appreciate your time. Dr. David Ellington is a family physician in Lexington, Virginia. He joined us from his office. Dr. Carolyn Barley-Britton is Associate Professor of Clinical Neurology at Columbia University. She's also the immediate past president of the National Medical Association. That's the National Association of African American Physicians, and she joined us from her office in New York. And I thank you both again for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we're going to continue our coverage of the situation at the University of California at San Diego, where a series of racially charged incidents have caused tensions. We'll speak to two student leaders to get their sense of where things are in just a few minutes. But first, this nation's capital legalized same-sex marriage yesterday, and today, another nation's capital also legalized same-sex marriage and adoption. We're talking about Mexico City. Joining us now from Mexico City is journalist Frank Contreras. He's a frequent contributor to Al Jazeera and the BBC, and he's at the Civil Registry right now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. I'm glad to be with you live from Mexico City here.
What's the scene like at the Civil Registry?
Well, I can see dozens of couples out now standing in front of this government building. It's an old government building. Looks like the old-fashioned, almost even a church. There's that sort of tone to this day. And they're standing around. They've got documents in their hands. And for the first time ever, they're calling this a historic day. People are coming out into public holding hands. And this is not something you see very often in Mexico. Lesbian and gay couples. And they're preparing to turn in their documents now and begin the legal process of getting their marriage license. They will now have all of the same rights that heterosexual couples have had now for centuries in Mexico, legal rights to be able to take out loans together, and even to be able to adopt children, Michelle.
Now, for those who might not know, Mexico allows Mexico City to pass its own laws separately from the rest of the country. And I wanted to ask, was this a popular measure when it passed? It passed apparently in December.
Well, you can imagine among the gay and lesbian community, it was a tremendously popular measure. They said they've been struggling now for 30 years to try to get this right. And so they think that this is a tremendous thing. But there are other members of the Mexican capital here, other people who live in the capital, I should say, who have their doubts. They're not so worried. Many people told me this is not any sort of scientific survey that I took, but just talking to people in the streets, I was told that most people don't seem to be against the idea of same-sex couples marrying, but what they do have their worries about is the idea that they can adopt children. There's still this idea in Mexico among many people that, even in the capital here, that a child raised in a home with two people from the same sex, that's something that could damage the child. And so there are psychologists that are working with people here and trying to educate the Mexican society to show that probably that's not going to be the case. Many studies have shown that children raised with same-sex couples can be, you know, healthy children as long as they receive proper health care, love, all the basic things you need in a household. So Mexican society is today on page one of this very long new book, The New Life of a Society Accepting Its Gay and Lesbian Couples Openly. But this is just in the capital. This is not happening all over the country, Michelle.
Sure. But I wanted to ask, though, how the rest of the country is reacting to this news. But before I do, I wanted to ask you about, again, the scene at the Civil Registry. What kinds of couples are you seeing there? Are they older? Do they seem like they've been together for a long time? Are they younger folks? Can you just give us a sense of the scene?
Well, the ones who have gathered today and are taking advantage of the very first hour you can turn in your documents, they're mostly activists. The people I spoke to are young people who are from Mexico City. They're upper middle class people. They have university educations. Some of them are lawyers. Some of them are doctors. And most of them, as I said, are activists. They have been involved in this measure to try to bring about, you know, to bring about the law that we have today. So they know about the legal side of this as well. These are people who understand the social barriers that have been in place for many, many years here in Mexico that have prohibited this kind of thing from happening. And so the people we see today are sort of, they've gathered because I think they know there were going to be television cameras. And we see TV cameras from networks from around the world are here, and also, of course, Mexican national television and Latin American television. Remember, Latin America remains a very Catholic and conservative region of the world, and it's not very common to even see people holding hands, gay couples, lesbian couples holding hands in public. So you are seeing that right now. I see the flag that you see all over the world, the multicolored flag that represents the gay and lesbian rights movement. And a lot of reporters and other people standing around. There are people who are also here getting their birth certificates and death certificates. That's what you do at the Civil
Registry. So business of the rest of the business goes on as well.
Right. And a lot of them, a lot of the other people who are heterosexuals are watching and they're wondering. And I think they're probably wondering, what does this mean for our society?
What about the rest of the country? Any sense of how this measure is going to be received? How it's being reported in the rest of the country?
Absolutely. There's already been a very strong sign of that from at least seven different Mexican states. Mexico, by the way, is called the United States of Mexico, and there are 31 states plus the federal district. And in at least seven of those, they're governed by the Conservative National Action Party. That's the ruling party, the party of President Felipe Calderón. And that party, in those states, the state governors have brought legal challenges to the law coming into effect today. And they tried doing that already in the last couple of months. They took those challenges right to Mexico's Supreme Court, Michelle, and the Supreme Court has overturned the challenges so far. But there still remains one major challenge that the Supreme Court must take into consideration. It's a constitutional challenge that says that the idea of two people of the same sex marrying and becoming a family union is against the Mexican Constitution from this conservative perspective because it can damage the Mexican family. They're thinking about it as a danger to the Mexican family institution. Mm. And, of course, that is an important institution in this country. And that legal challenge is coming straight from the Attorney General's office. Imagine the Attorney General of the nation is bringing that challenge to the Supreme Court. And, of course, he's a staunch supporter of President Felipe Calderón on the right-wing side of the Mexican political system. And, of course, that measure is getting a lot of support from the Catholic Church. They're pouring in money to help bring the legal challenge and also bringing in their own lawyers.
Interesting. All right.
This is a controversial thing.
All right. Well, thank you, Frank. Journalist Frank Contreras is a frequent contributor to Al Jazeera and the BBC, and he was kind enough to join us by phone from Mexico City. He's at the Civil Registry right now where marriage licenses are being offered to same-sex couples for the first time. Frank, thank you so much for speaking with us.
I'm glad to be with you. Thank you.
We want to return now to a story we've been following out of the University of California at San Diego. Racial tensions have been flaring there since early last month when a white fraternity hosted a party off campus that they called the Compton Cookout. They urged partiers to come dressed up in what they called ghetto fashions. The party sparked an intense reaction on campus. And then the editor of a campus newspaper upped the ante when he went on campus TV and mocked those who opposed the party in even more racially offensive terms. terms. He used the N-word. That led the student body president to suspend funding for all student media outlets. In recent days, a noose was found in the campus library. A young woman claimed responsibility, saying she didn't understand the connotations. And more recently, a pillowcase fashioned to look like a Ku Klux Klan hood was found atop a statue outside the campus library. We wanted to know more about what was going on, so we've called Utsav Gupta. He is the student president of UC San Diego. He was with us last week to tell us about what was happening then. Also with us, Alec Wiseman. He's the editor-in-chief of the California Review. That's a conservative student-run paper at the university. And I welcome you both, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Michelle.
Thank you for having me on very much.
Well, thank you both for coming. So I wanted to ask each of you, Utsav, I'll ask you first as the sort of the representative of the students on the whole. What would you say is the mood on campus? How do you think these incidents are affecting the mood there?
Yeah, I don't think it's helping the mood at all. It's been really disappointment after disappointment in certain members of our community, really terrorizing other members of our campus with repeated acts of hate speech and racism. But at the same time, I think there is hope that now that we're forming a dialogue around these issues, that we can make a stronger UCSD.
And when you say terrorizing, you mean do some students feel actively threatened behind this?
Oh, yeah. No, I was at the aftermath of the hanging of the noose. I could see students who were visibly afraid of being on campus. They would only walk in groups. They would carpool home. They were looking for safe space. So it's definitely making students here feel unsafe.
Alec, what do you think about that? What's your sense of the mood on campus? Do you agree with Utsav?
The majority of the campus, I haven't seen. Most of people are wondering why this is going on. I don't think it's necessarily that people are feeling unsafe to the degree that it's being portrayed. However, there are certain people who do feel unsafe. There have been people who have gotten death threats, not necessarily members of the BSU, but members of people such as the other newspaper, The Koala, gotten death threats. And there are other individuals who may not have supported the agenda necessarily of the BSU have gotten death threats.
Are you saying you've gotten death threats?
I have not gotten death threats.
Well, can I ask you, Alec, while I have you, why do you think this is happening? I had a chance to talk to Utsav last week and to get his take. What's your sense of why this is happening?
There's two parts to it. One, I think that the school overreacted in the initial situation with the party, leading to being opening themselves up for the Koala, which is an equal opportunity offensive newspaper, to find a story that could get them massive publicity, massive coverage. And by making that unsensitive remarks on TV, that's all it's done.
You mean Koala? The Koala is the paper that was offensive. And you're saying that you think the university overreacted to this?
I think they overreacted to the initial incident with the Compton Cookout Party.
Why? How so?
Because what they did is they spammed most of the students' inboxes with multiple letters about it. When it was an off-campus party, when it was protected by free speech, and it wasn't thrown by any members of any... It was thrown by individuals, but not by any actual fraternity or sorority with student feet. It was done by individuals. It was insensitive. It was wrong. The school should have sent out maybe one, maybe two, but not spamming the entire student body's emails. And by doing that, they just waited. They were just opening themselves up for a Koala to do something about it. And it's done it. It's caused the Koala now to get over hundreds of thousands of hits in per day. It's caused them to get their issues downloaded in record bulk off their website. All it's done is it's given them more press.
So what's your take on that? What do you think about what Alec is saying? He thinks the university overreacted to the initial incident. What do you think?
Oh, I completely disagree. As I said before, I feel that the party was indicative of a campus climate that has been festering here at UC San Diego for years, and that the party was really what was the straw that broke the camel's back and really brought this dialogue out into the open. I think Alec is really speaking from a very misinformed standpoint, and I doubt he's talked to many members of the Black Student Union or other minority communities who are deeply affected by all of the recent actions that have occurred here.
What you have to say, though, is that a lot of the claims that the BSU had made, such as people are racist because they don't want to hand you because they don't hand people flyers, or people are racist because they don't sit next to you, isn't indicative of people being racist. It's indicative of people at UCSD in general being more concerned with their study than being social. Because you know what? People go and don't want to hand me a flyer. People go and don't want to sit next to me. randomly in class. I don't think it doesn't make them racist. It just makes them too busy concerned with their study. So I think a lot of this is being blown out of proportion. A lot of people need to calm down, need to be thinking rationally about these issues. And that's something being lost by the administration, by the BSU, by and especially members of the Associated Students, who acted rashly, such as you, Utsav, by shutting down the media funding.
Utsav, that speaks to another issue that you suspended the funding funding for student media organizations in the wake of the editor-in-chief's appearance on the campus station, and some people are saying that you overreacted. How do you respond to that?
I don't really see it as an overreaction. I mean, we've been reviewing the media funding bylaws since the beginning of the academic year, actually. And I just saw it as a problem that's been a part of our process in how we fund media organizations, that this process is completely open to abuse. It's been abused countless times over the past decade, and that now is the time to institutionally change how the Associated Students decides to fund media organizations.
Ella, can I ask you two questions, which is, has the cutoff of funding affected your publication?
Yeah, it actually has.
How?
Tried to go in print last week, and we were denied because of the funding freeze.
And can I ask you, though, about the comments that the editor of the Koala made, where he used the term ungrateful, and I don't see a need to repeat it again. He used the N-word, ungrateful N-word, to describe the students who objected to this party. Can I ask you, what do you make of that? I mean, we often have this image of kind of younger people your age, as being more colorblind than their seniors, of not engaging in this kind of stereotyping of their peers. And I just wanted to get, what's your sense of where did that come from? I don't know if you know the young man, but what's going on with that?
Yeah, I know him. I think it was wrong. At the same time, though, like I said, the Koala is equal opportunity offenders. But the source of all this comes from the media, comes from rap culture, comes from everywhere, that people just get away with saying it and they make money off of it. It's become a term that is overused by the media, and people just presume that, oh, it doesn't mean anything. And then they get away with using it, and people get upset. Unfortunately, though, the Constitution doesn't prevent people from getting offended. It just protects speech from all sides, so that way that people have the right to say it. And again,
you think he has the right to use a racial slur using student funds? Do you think he has a right to use racial slurs?
That's what the Constitution says in the case by the Southworth versus the Wisconsin Board of Regents. So the Supreme Court has decided over and over again that offensive speech, even if being used by student fees, is covered. That's why UTSAV had to shut down all media organizations and couldn't just target the Koala. Now, they've been trying to target the Koala now for the entire year. That's why they've been looking into all these funds.
Okay.
And
right.
Never been able to do it in a way that could let them shut down all the media organizations until now.
Okay. I'm going to give Utsav a final thought here. What do you think is going to happen next? What do you think is the next step here in this whole thing? Do you sense things are calming down a bit, or do you think more?
Today is actually March 4th, mm-hmm. which is going to be a tremendous day of action across the state, both with the UCs, the California state school system, and the community colleges. I actually think you're going to see in the media today a very active protest, not only about the racial climate here at UC San Diego, but about access and affordability.
All right. Well, keep us posted. Utsav Gupta is the student body president at the University of California at San Diego, and Alec Weissman is editor of the California Review, a conservative student-run paper at the University of California at San Diego, and they both joined us from there. And I thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yesterday, Tell Me More producer Lee Hill blogged about the situation at UC San Diego. To read his thoughts and see video of how the black students on campus are reacting, go to the Tell Me More blog, log on to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, a look at the most powerful woman in television and how she also helped revolutionize the film industry, Oprah Winfrey. It's part of our Divas on Screen series about black women in film. The Oscars are this weekend. That's coming up. But first, we want to talk about black men for a moment, because on just about any day, there is some tragic story about black men in the news, on the internet, or bandied about at the water cooler. And often those stories are about how black men are mistreated by police or underserved served by educators or about how they are falling short in some way. But sociologist LaRue Lewis, who is himself a black man, has been thinking about and documenting a fresh take on the question of black men and race and power. It's a theory that he calls black male privilege. And if that raises your eyebrows, you are not alone. So we called him to find out more. LaRue Lewis is an assistant professor of sociology at the City University of New York, and he joins us now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
So define black male privilege. I'm sure that's a phrase on its face that will get people to sit up and take notice.
My working definition is really a system of built-in and often overlooked systematic advantages that center the experience and the concerns of black males while minimizing the power that black males hold, which is a fancy way of saying we are absolutely used to talking about African-American men in crisis, and we can talk about this crisis so much that we miss the ways in which black men are oppressed and can also serve as oppressors.
And when we say privileged, I think generally people think of privilege in relation to whom. So when you think of privilege, are you speaking relative to someone?
Absolutely. Black male privilege is first centered as being relative to black women. I'm not comparing black male's privilege to white male privilege. I think one could argue that, but it'd be a very dangerous leap. When we look in the African American community, there are actually spaces where black men are advantaged and often sometimes dominate a dialogue when we should be listening more carefully to what's happening with black women equally.
Give an example.
In particular, if we think about the narrative of mass incarceration, we think about the ways in which black men and black boys have been locked up at increasing rates since the 1980s. While this is true, the fastest growing incarceration rate is particularly among black and Latino women. And because we haven't thought seriously about what's happening with black girls and Latina girls, we tend to make the issue of incarceration solely male, and we miss the different ways in which we need to be intervening, not just for our young boys, but also our young girls.
Well, give another example then, because I think people would say, focusing on those who are even worse off than you doesn't mean you're well off.
Well, the first time I really came to think about black male privilege was when I was a freshman at Morehouse College. And at that point, there was actually an incident of sexual assault between a Morehouse student and a Spelman student. And what I found quickly were that black men were, instead of actually talking seriously about issues of sexual assault, which are very common in our community, it became a discussion about the ways in which black men become vilified. So what happens is we often look at issues like domestic violence or sexual assault, and instead of actually dealing with those who are survivors or the victims of it, predominantly African-American women, we recenter it on black men.
What's driving this, in your view? Is it their idea that group solidarity is so important in the African-American community? Somehow the community has made a decision that when there's an issue involving black men and black women, that black men are to be favored?
I think you've unfortunately identified one of the central issues with black male privilege. So often black men are used to being under attack that when it comes to being accountable for the actions we may have, we quickly say, well, I couldn't possibly be doing anything wrong. Look at all the ways in which I'm oppressed. Look at all the ways in which I'm at the bottom of the barrel. What that does is robs us of an opportunity to actually build stronger community, and it robs black men of a chance to actually take hold of the actions that they have so that we can empower the community.
What reaction do you get when you talk to people about this?
Among black women in particular, I get a lot of amens and saying, thank you for actually exposing this. Among black men, one of the most common ones I get is, well, this seems ridiculous. It's an oxymoron. How could black men be privileged? It's like jumbo shrimp. It doesn't add up. And they say, you know, what did my black male privilege get me? I'm unemployed. What did my black male privilege get me? I'm in jail. And what I have to unfortunately explain is one of the things that black male privilege allows you to do is center your oppression to the exclusion of others. So instead of saying, why, yes, there are ways in which black men are promoted more often than black women. Why, yes, there are ways in which you reach certain educational levels, black men get higher pay rates than their black female counterparts who are equally skilled. We should be turning that on its head and saying, how do we make sure black women have equal parity to us, instead of saying, hey, I got to keep the little ground that I have. And I think that for a long time, the reason that black women are often speaking up in support of this is because black feminists have challenged us to think differently and said, hey, black men, brothers, could you look out for us as we look out for the whole? As black feminists have taught us, there can be no liberation for half a race.
How did you get started on this? Because I take your point that this is a point of view that has been advanced, not popularly by, you know, African-American women, particularly African-American feminists, but it is not one that has been particularly well received. So I'm interested in how you, as a male scholar, got interested in this.
Initially, my first exposure was actually around the Million Man March. I felt that I was transformed by the Million Man March, and I thought it was one of the most powerful events ever. And I was having a conversation in class with a professor, Dr. Beverly Guy-Sheftall, and she said that she couldn't support the Million Man March because it was very patriarchal and it put black men at the center. And I said, well, it doesn't always have to be patriarchal. You don't always have to put black men at the center. And she said, isn't it an amazing privilege to tell someone else what they don't have to take seriously? And that paused me for a moment. I said, wow. What is it in my past that makes me say I can define what someone else should think of as important?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with LaRue Lewis. He's a professor of sociology at the City University of New York, and we're talking about his theory of black male privilege. The other sensitive area that you've talked about in this is, you know, how can I put this in a way that is something that we can discuss in a family setting? Negotiating sex.
Absolutely.
Which is an issue that's is you know, a very real and much discussed issue in the African American community. Is it partly your theory that the imbalance on college's campuses, the imbalance in education, high incarceration rates, partly because of all those things, that black men who are not subject to those issues, those negatives, and who are in essence taking advantage by being selfish when it comes to negotiating sex, or kind of using their power?
I think it's a perfect example of privilege. With a shrinking number of eligible black men who are educated, who are employed, etc., those of us who have made it through the ranks, made it through the crisis, right, as they often call it, we end up having or engaging in dating practices and even married men in practices in which, instead of actually exercising discretion, it's like a kid in a candy store. It's like, well, I can have Reese's and I can have Hershey's and I can have M&M's. And then when you ask brothers what they're doing, they're like, well, as Jewel Woods has found in his book, Don't Blame It on Rio, they'll suggest that it's actually reward for all of the issues that they faced as a black man, which now we have this ongoing narrative of black single women who can't find mates. And it centers on what are the issues of black women. Of course, Jimmy Israel just released a book, The Denzel Principle, and it says why black women can't find good black men, versus saying, well, what are the things that brothers are doing that are also impacting how people date, impacting mate selection, and impact how we build a community.
What do you, what about that argument that if black men are saying that, you know, maybe they didn't get a chance to experience the patriarchy back when it was fashionable for white men, you know? Maybe they didn't get to sort of have that power position in society, and they say, it's my turn. What do you say to that?
Well, I say it can be your turn if you're most concerned with your own self-aggrandizement. If you're interested in a community growing and developing, you have to realize when you put the brakes on privilege. All too often, people who have the opportunity to change a system when they get to the top continue it. Particularly as black men, we should be aware that those who are in power will often try to recreate the same cycles of oppression. Why would we want to do that to our sisters, to our mothers, and to our community at large?
What would you say to those, and this has been an argument since the 60s, as you know, that in fact, the African-American community is in fact matriarchal, that African-American women, relative to men, have more power than among other groups and are, in fact, the privileged. The argument is that they are more tolerable or more accepted by the white power structure, that they are considered easier to get along with, that they, in fact, have more power within families because they tend to be the heads of households. What do you say to those who argue that, in fact, this community is matriarchal?
Right. I think, you know, and I fully address it as the myth of black matriarchy, because what you're talking about are limited spaces and zones of power. We do know among service sector jobs, black women are more likely to be employed. But we do know among the jobs that provide the greatest amount of advancement, the greatest amount of security, black women are less likely to get hired, less likely to get promoted, and less likely to have suitable wages. When you have a system that doesn't allow black women full opportunity, then they're going to have to try to operate in small spaces in which they may have some form of power. When people start advancing and suggesting, well, the black community is matriarchal because black women are heads of households, it was often because of the absence of black men. Black men absolving responsibility or trying to step around it have left black women trying to run things on their own. And I think as a community, it's our job to come together as egalitarian bodies to try to make for a better family structure, a better community.
What do you want to happen now as a result of the conversations that you have sparked with this? I know you presented your thoughts at your alma mater. I don't know what reaction you got there. And so what do you want to have happen?
Right. As you alluded to, I presented this talk at Morehouse, which actually had the courage to invite me down and then even put it up on the internet. So I want to salute them for that. And one of the things I said we need to do seriously on college campuses is take the issue of men's studies. How does gender operate? Not just for women, but for men. What does it mean to be between privilege and peril? We need to, as black men, also engage study circles. It's not just what you do in the classroom, but what you do outside. How do you learn and figure out how you negotiate and how you can actually be someone who's not just helpful to the individual, but the community as a whole? And lastly, even if you're not in school, be accountable. When you see brothers acting out in ways that can be damaging to themselves, to their families, and the larger community, just really tap a brother and say, hey, is that actually the way you want to go? Because more times than not, when I actually engage black men, I find that making us consider the actions we're doing can be revolutionary and transformative.
LaRue Lewis is Assistant Professor of Sociology and Black Studies at the City University of New York. He was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. If you want to see him present his paper at Morehouse, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More. Professor Lewis, thank you so much for speaking with us, and do keep us in touch as you talk more about this. We'll be interested in the reactions that you continue to get.
Thank you for having me on.